Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, but yeah, so now we got everybody here. But yeah, it's definitely a little bit of a trip down memory lane last weekend.
So we took our nibbling to college, which is at my alma mater with my sister. His alma mater was 10 miles away.
Yep, just up the road.
And yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're loving it, by the way. They're having so much fun. It's awesome. But yeah.
But yeah, so did that, then you drove cross country with your sister.
I did. I drove from New York to New Mexico in 4 days.
Got back Saturday.
My body's still not happy with me.
And, now here we are.
But I did get to visit a fellow independent ghost tour operator in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. Went on Old Town Albuquerque history and ghost tours, and it was fabulous, so I definitely recommend, if you guys go to Albuquerque, check them out.
And if you ever need a reminder on that, or if you're ever traveling anywhere and you want a recommendation for a local ghost tour,
let us know.
Let us know. We'll go ahead. We'll help you find the locally owned and operated tour in whatever area that you are traveling to, assuming that they exist.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of locally owned and operated locally owned and operated tours all across the country and even around the world. So, yeah, we're happy to go ahead and help you find those.
In fact, I helped one of the guys who was heading off to Europe in just a few weeks. I was like, okay, in York, this is where you want to go. In Edinburgh, this is where you want to go. He's like, I booked this tour. I said, that is with the right company.
Lee
is not here tonight. We're getting texts from Lee.
But hi, Lee. I'm assuming that they're watching, because I think that they're watching and then sending us comments. But hi, Lee. I'm assuming you're somewhere in the crowd there this evening. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry that you can't be with us here this evening.
Yeah.
But yeah, so
we're missing you.
Yeah.
Vincent's pouting over there and sleeping.
Vincent's usually pouting and sleeping.
Yeah.
It's kind of his.
His MO.
His default mode.
And Nico is not happy because I took over his box from my crafty for the Halloween build.
Which has started.
There are crafts everywhere.
Yeah.
And free.
y'all came here to talk about haunted colleges and universities.
Yes.
Again. This is volume two.
Volume two. I have an international of volume three and four started.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Just so y'all know.
This will not be the last time you hear about haunted colleges and universities.
We might need to do a back to school in January.
Yeah. We don't even relegate all of our colleges and universities to these episodes. I mean, University of North Dakota.
Yeah.
That was a huge one. Took up a good chunk of our haunted North Dakota show that we did.
Barely scratched the surface.
When we did Columbus, we talked
a little bit there, and again, barely scratched the surface.
So there's a lot of spirited history associated with academia all over the place. But yeah, so we got a lot to talk about this evening.
Tell like I know, and you can check the comments.
Yeah, I'll try catching up on the comments. But
if Mr. Nico will let you. Oh, look, that page.
You don't fall asleep there?
He's like, no, but you got to keep heading me. Anyway. So it's the end of August, meaning that students across the country are heading back to their institutions of higher learning, if they haven't already checked back into the dormitories already. For many of these students, the college experience will not only define some of the most formative years of their lives, but it will define much of their existence even after they have departed the classroom for the merciless grind of the real world. For some, the alma mater is a point of pride, but something that they can look back on with a sense of accomplishment and nostalgia. This is not to say that their pride is necessarily limited to graduates, but also current students, family members, staffers, professors, and even members of the surrounding community can all develop an emotional attachment to their various colleges and universities across the country and around the world. This might go a long way towards explaining why some of them have become a little more permanently attached to their schools than they ever attended. their school pride, outliving their mortal existence. For some colleges and universities, they sometimes find themselves becoming a permanent homes of the spirits that have decided to, of course, skip the administration process. And the institutions that host these lingering spirits, they handle them in their various ways. Some embrace them as part of the institution's culture. I will say, at my alma mater, there is an FYP dedicated to ghost legends and lore. Chris and I were very happy. We're like, we could teach that. I'm sorry, buddy.
What was that?
I spooked him. I'm sorry, buddy. Come back up here. Nope, we are so spooked right now.
Oh, dear.
Okay, moving on. Some refuse to acknowledge their existence, and others, well, they just step aside and let them do their thing. After all, classes need to go on. Okay. Oh, there. Since we're starting in Europe.
Yeah, so this was a college campus that I went to numerous times when I was in my youth.
Swimming.
Yeah, swimming. So when all growing up, I was in swimming. So I did competitive swimming. My parents got me involved with the YMCA League when I was like 5 years old. And I just, well, I never quit until I ultimately graduated college. So
and
I just stuck with it. And, well, yeah, then I coached for a year. So it was something that I did a lot and wanted traveling all across New York State and beyond as part of some of the competitions that I was in. And for this first stop, it's in central New York, and we find the city of Cortland. Now, originally an industrial town, life in modern Cortland largely revolves around the State University of New York at Cortland, or SUNY Cortland for short. Originally founded as the Cortland Normal School in 1868, this center of learning has grown into a respected institution that has hosted many generations of students, with upwards of 6,500 students on campus in any given year, plus the staff and faculty that support the school's day-to-day business. With so many people coming and going from this 211-acre campus, it's of little surprise that a few spirits have hung on here over the years. The most prominent spooky stories from SUNY Cortland feature an array of characters, including a football player, a former cook, and a ghost named Elizabeth. Not you. You're still here. On the seventh floor of Clark Hall, near the center of campus, the spirit of a red dragon makes an annual appearance. Now, before you start thinking of fire-breathing scaly creatures or perhaps the Hannibal Lecter book, the Red Dragons are the sports teams for SUNY Cortland. Kind of a cool mascot, if you ask me.
I'll take it.
Yeah. For the purpose of this story, the Red Dragon in question is the aforementioned member of the football team. His identity is unknown, but he does cut a bit of a frightful figure when he shows up. He's seen in his uniform and has a cut above his eyebrow that perpetually bleeds. He's affectionately known as the Gridiron Ghost. He's most frequently seen roaming about the hallways and sitting outside on the windowsill of the seventh floor of Clark Hall. The Cortland football program was established back in 1893, so it has a long history and many thousands of players have come and gone from its roster over the years. Our best guess is that the Gridiron Ghost is the spirit of a bygone player who makes an occasional trip back to campus to relive some of the glory days. But barring some more definitive evidence, we will likely never know for sure. Moving towards the old center of campus, we can find Brockway Hall, a cornerstone building in the university's major expansion in the early 1950s. Flanked by Cheney and DeGroat Halls on either side, Brockway Hall was originally a multi-purpose building that featured a major dining hall. While the dining facilities have moved on to more modern structures, there are still some snack amenities available in the building. And it's here that things took a turn for the weird one morning. As the story goes, students making a pot of coffee in the kitchen caught sight of a man standing at the top of a staircase. This is the set of stairs that leads to the ground floor as well as the loading dock. When the students asked him if they could assist him in any way, he simply turned away and left without saying another word. He vanished into thin air by passing through the small break room adjacent to the kitchen. A thorough investigation fails to identify the mysterious man, but he became known as the cook due to his tendency to hang around the kitchen area. We must wonder if he might be keeping company with our next spirit. As previously noted, connecting the Brockway Hall on the north is Cheney Hall. It's here that lingers the spirit of Elizabeth. once a resident of Cheney Hall in the early 1980s, it's said that in a rage, her boyfriend pushed her from the porch.
Mail
just got here. Okay. Said that in a rage, her boyfriend pushed her from the fourth floor staircase. The university embraced her untimely death as a mural was erected in her honor. Ever since, strange occurrences have occurred on the grounds. Students living on the fourth floor have reported being overtaken by an uneasy feeling after looking at Elizabeth's mural, with some stating that it felt as if the painting was looking back at them. Others have seen Elizabeth herself as a misty figure that approaches people with arms stretched out. By the time you try to focus on her, she vanishes into thin air. Ironically, after her death, another female student fell in the same manner as Elizabeth from the fourth floor. Being drunk at the time, she leaned too far across the banister and fell. Amazingly, she was unharmed from the incident. Perhaps she was aided by her unfortunate predecessor? Elizabeth has taken on a role as protector, as she has been known to frighten off boyfriends threatening violence on female residents. Moving to Shea Hall, we have the firsthand account of a student named Valerie. Valerie stated that the women's bathroom on the second floor of Shea Hall has a ghost whom I have seen at least twice. All of my paranormal experiences in this bathroom have been late at night when it's very quiet and I seem to be alone. I have seen the toilet stall doors or their shadows when I am in a stall move when there was no one around, and certainly no air moving through the space. They have not opened or nor closed completely, nor made a sound. It's as if an invisible hand is quietly pushing or pulling the door part way. Once while washing my face, and thus my glasses were off, I briefly noticed a figure reflected in the mirror. The figure passed behind me going towards the shower. When I finished at the sink, I peeked into the shower area and called out so I wouldn't turn off the light on anybody, but nobody was there. I just chalked it up as strange yet unimportant and went to bed. On another occasion, I was again washing my face and no one else was in the bathroom. This time, I was looking at myself in the mirror and I clearly saw a young Caucasian lady with slightly wavy brown hair wearing a white nightgown glide silently behind me and move towards the bathroom door. Despite my glasses not being on, she was close enough to me that I could see her features in the mirror. I did not feel anything when she passed me. I thought it was my roommate, since this person looked like her. I finished up and realized that I never heard nor saw the door open, and nobody was in any of the stalls nor in the showers. When I returned to my dorm, my roommate was fast asleep and wearing a black camisole. I will note that at no time did I ever feel afraid, and I honestly didn't think I was seeing ghosts at first. I may have seen or noticed a ghost passing back and forth in this bathroom at other times and simply thought it was a fellow student. I have felt that whatever was in there was not aware of living people. SUNY Cortland is one of those institutions that somewhat embraces its spooky nature, somewhat being here. History classes at the university have studied ghost stories on campus and have even developed a ghost tour of the campus as a tool to study how lore is passed down over generations. Associate Professor Evan Falkenberry says of the story, even if you don't believe in ghosts, and I'm one, ghost stories can reveal the way people in the past held attitudes, beliefs, and values. The popular ghost stories that get passed between students at SUNY Cortland, for example, can tell us about what students cared about on campus going back to the 1980s. In addition to previously mentioned locations, the ghost tour also shares some haunted lore from Corey Union and Van Hoosen Hall, all spooky stories that were excavated from deep in the university archives at the Memorial Library. According to Falkenberry, the real-life influences behind shadowy apparitions was a worthy topic, which focused on how scholars interpret human curiosity about the afterlife. Interestingly, Falkenberry and his students found that most of the stories were recorded around the same period in the 1980s, at the time when the campus opened the Voice office in Corey Union, where diverse campus community members could express their concerns. Also at this time, the counseling center shifted from serving as an academic remediation center to offering students emotional support. Fulton Berry's class concluded that although any direct link between the hauntings and the campus reaction had been lost to history, the campus community responded to the reports of supernatural vision by assisting any students who might be struggling with mental health issues or as survivors of domestic violence. Student Emma Effing came to a conclusion that she wasn't anticipating as a part of the project. She said, although the project started out as finding out whether these stories were real or not and how they grew up on campus, this project turned into finding out how these ghost stories helped the campus become more inclusive and more aware of sexual abuse and mental health issues on campus. Moral of the story, ghost stories are more than just stories.
Yep. Alright, so now we're going to move out to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. That's right, Miami University is in Oxford, Ohio.
Oh, I addressed this.
So, this is in the southwest corner of Ohio. In a modern context, we can quite, you know, make it seem confusing because it's nowhere near Miami, Florida, nor is it related to the University of Oxford in England. That said, Miami University is named for the nearby Miami River, founded in 1809, making it more than 80 years older than the city in Florida. There is your history lesson for today.
Miami University, long before the city of Miami.
Pardon. I'm sorry. As for the city of Oxford, which was established a year after the university to support the institution, making it a true college town, with lofty aspirations of the university, it was deemed appropriate to name the city after one of the more well-known college towns in the world, Oxford, England. Given the nature of their founding, Miami University and Oxford, Ohio have supported one another in their respective growth, making them both well-renowned and well-maintained in the modern era. That fact, Oxford, Ohio, top Forbes best list of the best college towns in America in 2014. A legitimate little piece of paradise in the Midwest. Giving me some little alliteration here.
I tried.
Lingering behind the beautiful facades of this historic academic locale lurks some otherworldly tales, particularly those that like to come out at night. According to the university student newspaper, the Miami Student, the university could become home to a presence whose origin lies in a legend dating back to the 1940s. Tales of the Miami motorcycle ghost have been recounted by generations of students, making it one of the most enduring stories from this corner of the country. So let's picture something that is part ghost rider, part headless horse. This theme story starts with a rebellious young man on a motorcycle who was courting a farmer's daughter in the Oxford area. Predictably, the farmer didn't care for this young man, seeing him as nothing more than trouble on two wheels. Excuse you, who just tried to nibble and I took my hand away. All right, so farmer forbade his daughter from spending time with the young man, but you can imagine how that works. The young man and the farmer's daughter kept in touch, and in the dead of night, they would set out on the motorcycle for adventures far beyond the farmer's gaze. The story came to a tragic end one night after the young man, while on his way to propose to the girlfriend, collided with a strip of barbed wire connecting two fence posts, promptly detaching his head from the rest of his body. Seeing that the cyclist's gruesome death isn't far from Miami University's campus, and years later, the stories of various sightings proliferated through the student's body. Allegedly, at a certain point during the night, bystanders are liable to see a light faintly glowing from the motorcycle's headlight illuminating in the night. It seems that the young man may still be on his final ride trying to get to his beloved. Searching for the motorcycle spirit has been a favorite pastime in some of the fraternities on Miami University campus. Adventurous types, or those who are there, will drive out to the dilapidated farmhouse that was believed to be the young man's destination for the final night. From there, they will wait and watch, sometimes daring the motorcyclist to come out and show himself. We say, watch for about what you wish for, dear. Remember this, Ray? You don't want to see him. As a person, don't want to see him either. Moving on. Moving to the eastern edge of campus, we're going to find Peabody Hall. Once a part of the Western Female Seminary, this institute stood independent of Miami University for 100 years before it was absorbed into the larger institution in 1974. Throughout most of its standalone existence, Western Female Seminary enjoyed a cordial, if not always warm, relationship with the neighboring Miami University. During the 19th century, contact between the men and the women of the two institutions was strictly controlled by administrators in concern for the moral well-being of their charges. Y'all know what happened out in the woods beyond their eyes. Let's say. The Western Female Seminary principal, Helen Peabody, an outspoken opponent of co-education, was especially protective of her students and always suspicious of the Miami men, who occasionally, and not always innocently, wandered onto their property. Miss Peabody took her convictions to the grave, and it's hard not to imagine how she would have reacted at the sight of Miami men freely roaming the corridors of the hall that now bear her name. In fact, it appears Miss Peabody may have done far more than merely turn over in her grave. According to some witnesses, her spirit leaves the tomb occasionally to watch over the women of Peabody Hall and to haunt the men who now dare to walk its corridors. Those who have seen her claim that Helen Peabody remains in death as she was in life, a very formidable woman. Well, then there's the Oxford Stimmies and Henry Ford. Miami University's biggest sports fan of the first half of the 20th century, and perhaps the nation's biggest gate crasher. During his time, Harry claimed to have gotten into 20 World Series games, 8 Rose Bowls, 3 Orange Bowls, a Sun Bowl, without paying. He also claimed that he had attended 64 consecutive Miami homecoming games. It's very likely that Harry's claims are greatly exaggerated, but he was a familiar figure at Miami sporting events until his death in March 1950. He'd be decked out in a white suit and a hat, carrying an umbrella and a megaphone, sporting a mouthful of diamond-studded teeth. Harry was loved by the student body. But his headline-grabbing antics were a frequent source of misery for the administrators. Among these was his assertion that the Miami game outcomes were revealed to him in his dreams at night before they were played. He would predict those outcomes through his megaphone on game day, announcing to the crowd that I had a dream last night. Whatever one's opinion of Harry was, there was no doubt that he loved Miami University. In the early 1900s, he gave Miami a fountain built with his own hands in the area between the current King Library and Harrison Hall. As he did with all his work, Harry left his signature on the phone so visitors would know the building identity. Members of the Miami community had mixed views about the artistic qualities of Thorpe's work, and his fountain also gave that unwanted notoriety as a favorite spot for fraternity games and activities. But no matter the controversy, Harry lovingly maintained it for most of his life. But the fountain quickly fell into disrepair after his death and had to be replaced with a smaller one in 1952. In 1959, the fountain was too removed and because of septic problems, and it was replaced by a plaque and monument. This remaining token of remembrance may not be enough for Harry. He always wanted to be the center of attention, whether it be in life or death, and it's said that you can even try to communicate with Harry by standing on the fountain's former site and calling out his name. Saint Harry can't resist the temptation calling back to those who are brave enough as we have. He's just backing out the loop.
We'll count on it.
We're just pausing.
Harry was definitely quite the character.
Oh, yeah.
So, yes, now we're going to go ahead and we're going to circle back to New York to another college campus that I'm a little familiar with. I've had a few.
I had fun this time with the team giving him some.
Yeah, you did.
Trips down memory lane.
Yeah, memory lane. We'll go with that. So, we're going to land in the city of Troy, just in the north of Albany. Now, I could use some very colorful language in describing this stop, as the university in question is a rival to both of our respective alma maters, but particularly my own. But for
their booze.
For the sake of this evening's show, I'll take the high road as we delve into the haunting tales of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. You're a lot of fun. Established in 1824, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute is renowned as being the oldest technological research university in the United States, and is Maeve McEnany of the original Albany ghost tour notes, the university's age leaves it right as a place to have gathered many emotions over the years, leaving a spirited mark on the landscape. Maeve has been offering a Spirits of Rensselaer ghost tour since 2015, and will have a sampling of the tales that you might catch on that tour for you this evening. Starting behind Russell Sage Dining Hall, it seems that the building's namesake may linger on within the walls of this historic structure. Sage's story is a classic rags-to-riches tale. Started off with a limited education, but worked his way up and eventually became a millionaire who enjoyed a lavish, extravagant life as a bachelor. However, he was also a man with deep prejudice, a misogynist who hated education because he himself wasn't educated past primary school. When he died in 1906, he left all of his wealth to his wife, Olivia Sage. Olivia then provided the funds for building RPI's Russell Sage Dining Hall and Laboratory. She also used his money to fund an all-women liberal arts college named after him, Russell Sage College, in the heart of Albany. In doing this, Olivia supported women and education, the two things that Russell hated. Leaving Russell Sage rolling in his grave, since the completion of the Russell Sage Dining Hall and Laboratory and the Liberal Arts College, the spirit of Russell has been haunting these buildings named after him. Dark, menacing shadow figures have been attributed to Russell, and while no one has come to harm from their encounters, it is a heart-pounding experience that none have a desire to repeat. But there's more to the Sage Laboratory than Russell's spirit. In the 1970s, there was an experiment going on in the basement involving testing the pollution levels in the Hudson River. During this experiment, there was a spill which caused the laboratory to temporarily shut down. Worse, a woman came into contact with the spill and contracted a disease that subsequently resulted in her death. Since that tragic incident, a woman's spirit has been seen in the Sage Laboratory, with one professor reporting that they looked up from some paperwork to find the spectral woman glaring at them. In another case, a woman received an eerie and disturbing voicemail inside Sage Laboratory. The voicemail left her so shaken that she contacted the public safety office. Their investigation not only failed to identify the caller, but it also determined that there was no source for the call. It had effectively originated from nowhere, leading many to believe that it was the echo of a distressed call from the unfortunate woman who became ill and died from the accident in 1970. That was it. Sorry, I had a typo in here. Finding my place. Okay. Moving along, we will arrive at West Hall, the oldest remaining building on Rensselaer's campus. Originally built as Troy Hospital, the building opened in fall 1871 and remained in operation until 1913. The hospital was the first full-service hospital outside of New York City and was intended to treat the poor and indigenous of the city. But over the years, it developed private rooms for the more affluent members of the Troy community to have respite. In 1895, the hospital added a special operating room suite and began a nursing school. The hospital attracted several physicians of note. Dr. John Thorne was the first appointed physician. Thorne trained in England and was one of early Troy's most famous residents, and he was twice elected mayor. A service offered in 1905 was the availability of horse-drawn ambulance. After the hospital's usefulness drew to a close in 1913, the building sat vacant, languishing for a decade. In the spring of 1923, Bishop Gibbons of the Albany Catholic Diocese, began a drive to raise capital to transform the old Troy Hospital into a Catholic Central High School. The fundraising effort was successful, and during West Hall's tenure at Catholic Central High School, it acquired many of the classroom structures that remain today, including separate entrances for the boys and girls. To this day, the southernmost entrance is labeled boys, and the northernmost entrance is labeled girls, though enforcement of those gendered entrances has long since continued. The building was eventually transferred to RPI in 1952, and it was named West Hall, as it was the westernmost building on the campus. Very original. Following a complete renovation, the School of Humanities and Social Sciences and the Department of Geology occupied the building. In subsequent years, the building has also housed the Geology Museum, several campus offices, art studios, and space for the Rensselaer Symphony Orchestra. The building's long and varied history has left it ripe for ghostly tales, and both students and faculty have reported many strange sightings and happenings there over the years. Of all the stories, though, the most notable is Nurse Betsy, a nun thought to have cared for patients in the late 1800s. What had brought Betsy back to West Hall is uncertain. Some say that Betsy was killed in a fire while trying to rescue her patients. In another variation of the story, Betsy was a sinister woman who suffered a mental breakdown before killing several patients and herself. Some blend the two tales into a story that Betsy tortured the patients in the basement and then later died in a fire in the basement. Regardless of her fate, her spirit is often seen wandering West Hall, and she is also credited with the sound of a piano playing late at night and the smell of baking cookies. More ominously, students have also reported hearing disembodied screams and thuds, and many report feeling the presence of an unseen entity or experience feelings of being watched. With such a heritage, RPI's West Hall is the kind of place some will either seek out for class assignments, and others will try to schedule their classes to avoid a spirited confine. If you want to hear some more, check out the original Albany Ghost Tour for some more spirited tales from this campus in New York's Capital District. You get something.
I was just trying to look up a question.
What's the question?
Were there any haunted schools in your office?
Sterling, Illinois. The question.
Looking. As I said, I've got like two more scripts of Haunted Illinois, and I'm sure I haven't touched all our haunted universes, and I know I haven't touched all of these. So.
Oh, no, don't get the stuff to research.
All right. I know we've had some on the University of Illinois. So. Anyway,
yes.
Chris is going down on a research rabbit.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to move on down into Flagler College in St. Augustine, Florida. This is, of course, the oldest continuously inhabited city in the United States, and it's here that industrialist Henry Flagler built the stunning Pompilia Hotel in 1888. It was a true masterpiece of luxury and art that included spacious rooms, a courtyard, the fountain, and spectacular dining rooms. When it opened to the public, the hotel was ahead of its time with a cutting-edge technology such as electric lighting, fans, and elevators. Over the years, the Pompilia Hotel played an important role in Florida's history and tourism industry, housing guests from all over the world, including many famous musicians, writers, politicians. So for those of you that are not familiar with this, Henry Flagler is the one who built the original train to Key West. And this was the starting point.
There is more about that. You're getting ahead of yourself.
I'm sorry.
It's
but
okay.
We have mentioned this before when we talked about Key West. So, however, as we years past, the hotel fell into disrepair and started to garner negative attention for mysterious happenings and sightings. In 1967, a group of concerned citizens that recognized the value of the struggling hotel helped to arrange for its conversion into the cornerstone of the newly chartered Blackwood College. From mysterious hooded figures to strange noises echoing through the halls, there have been numerous reports of ghosts hovering around the campus throughout its storied past. The most famous clump on campus is known as the Gray Lady. Legend has it that she is Ida Alicia, the second wife of Flagler, and she can be seen wandering near the college's towers late at night. She is said to linger in a stupor, her gaze distant, her body hidden under a long flowing gray cloak. She has frightened a fair number of young women in the dorm as they have awakened to her staring at them. It may be that these young women remind Ida Alicia of someone she was not too fond of during her life, as Ida Alicia was concerned about her husband having a bit of a roving eye. Ida was believed to have struggled with manic depressive illness, which may have led to her paranoid feelings towards her husband. After all, she met Henry while he was while serving as a nurse to the first, Mrs. Flagler. Her illness didn't lead to her being committed to a mental hospital, when she eventually passed away. Even if you don't see the Gray Lady in the towers of Flagler College, some students have reported hearing strange noises emanating from this part of the college that now serves as dormitory. As far as Henry Flagler's potential affairs, some say he took up with the mistress when Ida was committed. Story goes that the mistress was distraught at Henry's behavior, or that she too struggled with depression, leading her to take her own life in the hotel. Since then, she's become the Woman in Black, an ominous spirited figure that is seen at the college today. Of course, the Woman in Black could be somebody else entirely, as the affair story of a fabrication of the critics of Flagler's community. No matter her origin, it doesn't make the encounter with the Woman in Black less unsettling. And that does bring us to the man himself, Mr. Henry Flagler. Now, saying he was an industrialist is true, but also a major simplification of his lifetime accomplishment. He's credited with transforming Florida's economy in the late 19th century. His passion for the state led him to build several luxury hotels here, including the original Ponce de Leon. This fortune was built largely off of his role as one of the founders of Standard Oil. And though he did add to his fortune as a founder of the Florida's East Coast Railway, which is the line that extends all the way to Key West, again, favorite place. Now, Flagler died in 1913 after a fall from his home in Palm Beach. His body was brought to the Salem to lay in state in the rotunda. It is said that when the time came to transport his remains to his final resting place at the mausoleum at the Memorial Presbyterian Church, all the rotunda doors slammed shut as his coffin was lifted from the dais. When they did get the doors open to move Mr. Flagler's remains away, it seems the spirit lingered behind. Many eyewitnesses' accounts describe a man who closely resembles Flagler wearing a white suit and a walking cane, moving through the rotunda on the fourth floor balcony and the college corridors today. Even though the college might not have been part of his vision for the Ponce de Leon, the students and staff at Flagler College like to think that he takes some pride in having his name on a college that continues to inspire students and be a major part of Florida's history.
That was a fun one.
It was.
I like that one. Yeah, I can't imagine that.
That hotel was phenomenal. Look at the old pictures of it.
Well, go look at the pictures of Flagler College now.
Yes.
It's still immaculate.
It's gorgeous.
Absolutely gorgeous. It's something else. Hi, buddy.
Are you playing it off of your life?
Seems that way. All right. I think we had a lot of fun ones tonight, actually. So, yeah, this next one. We're going to sweep you off to Transylvania University.
Not in Romania.
In Lexington, Kentucky. Sorry, no vampires here, but we may have a man entombed under the university's old Morrison.
Because why not?
More on that in a moment. Transylvania University was established as a law and medical school in Lexington in 1799. building on the legacy of the Transylvania Seminary that was established by an act of the Virginia Assembly in 1780 when Kentucky was still a part of the state of Virginia.
So connection to us.
Yep. Even more so, the university quickly gained a positive reputation as respected statesman and politician Henry Clay was appointed professor of law in 1805.
Our guy.
He is a Central Virginia native. So, he would go on to serve on the Board of Trustees and was a supporter of the university until his death in 1852. With Clay's support and the generally positive reputation of the university, many intellectuals and luminaries were drawn to the campus. One such individual was Constantine Rapinesque. Constantine was born in Constantinople in 1783.
But we're just bouncing all over the place.
It's Istanbul. Now it's Istanbul. But it was Constantinople.
Enter They Might Be Giants in my head.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome. Now, he was born in Constantinople in 1783 and immigrated to the United States in 1802. Here, he met a number of young botanists and began to collect specimens himself. In 1804, Constantine returned to Europe with his specimens and settled in Palermo, Sicily. In 1815, he returned to the United States and continued to work diligently in the fields of biology and zoology. He came to Lexington and the famed Transylvania University as a professor of botany in 1819. Throughout his career, Constantine published the binomial names of over 6,700 species of flora and fauna, but he was never recognized during his life for his work. Perhaps it was because he was a little too eccentric for anyone's taste. On one occasion in 1818, Constantine was on a trip down the Ohio River, when he stopped in Henderson, Kentucky at the home of John James Audubon, famed for his detailed color illustrations of birds in North America. In his room was Audubon's prized violin and a live bat, which Constantine did not recognize. So, well, Constantine picked up the violin, gave it a swing at the bat in an attempt to seize the bat as a specimen, and, well, the violin didn't make it. To thank him for destroying the violin, Audubon later gave his guest a beautiful color illustration of a devil-jack diamondfish, a 10-foot giant with bulletproof scales that swims in the depths of the Ohio River. Or so Constantine thought. Constantine wrote and published a paper on this beast, only to thereafter discover that Audubon had made up the creature as a joke. Needless to say, the two were not close. As a professor, Constantine was more likely to skip class than were his pupils. He used the time to take a nature walk. It is believed, but not confirmed, that Constantine also was quite friendly, too friendly, with the wife of college president Horace Holly. Further, Constantine, a Unitarian in faith, did not endear himself to the more conservative faith and faithful of Kentucky. So whatever the reason, Constantine was forced out of Transylvania in 1826. Upon his departure, however, he left a curse on both President Holly and Transylvania University itself. While the exact phrasing of the curse has been lost, the anger behind it has echoed through the generations. Since. The following year, Holly himself was forced from the college, whereupon he and his wife set out to teach in Louisiana. But Holly would not last long in the subtropical heat and humidity, and he caught yellow fever and died. Transylvania's main building, then within what is today Grass Park, burned within 2 years of the curse and will be replaced with a new central building known as Old Morrison in 1833. Constantine returned to Philadelphia after being relieved of his professorship and continued his work until his death from cancer in 1840. Without a church home, Constantine was buried in Ronaldson Cemetery at 9th and Bainbridge in Philadelphia. Ronaldson created his cemetery for travelers and others in Philadelphia who could not, without membership, be buried in a local church cemetery, but who would not be relegated to the public pauper's field. Even so, up to 6 bodies would share the same space at Ronaldson's. But when Ronaldson Cemetery was set to be destroyed in the 1920s, a group of Transylvania students came to recover the body of the old professor with the hope that the curse would end. And so his body was removed from its grave, brought to the campus of Transylvania University, and reinterred in a small crypt under the steps of Old Morrison. Several untoward things have happened that have been blamed on the curse, including the suicide of one student who is still said to haunt the university. Students sleeping in a certain dorm on campus have awoken to see a male in gym shorts standing at the foot of the bed who then vanishes. Old Morrison itself was nearly consumed by fire in 1969, but the structure was saved and restored and still stands as a symbol for the university. Though odd things still happen. Security guards are hesitant to walk the corridors at night, lest they be tricked by an unseen force. And when other rare, untoward events occur at the university, almost everyone gives a cautious glance back at the curse that has lingered over the campus for almost 200 years.
Patrick commented, six bodies in a grave that's crowded. That's actually typical. And a lot of the family graves, you go down enough so that you can pile on top of each other just to save space and money. So, not uncommon.
But Audubon had a sense of humor.
Yes, he did. Not the first lie about Audubon.
No. Although he didn't make up that one.
No, he didn't. But he did make up the pain, which is really cool, by the way.
Yes.
All right, so now we're going to end in Boston, Massachusetts with Boston University and Emerson College. These are the northeast of the Boston University campus and its neighbor. Considering the history of the city of Boston, it's easy to find haunted tales across the urban landscape, including on the grounds of the city colleges and universities. But for the sake of tonight, we're going to stick to these two institutions, and we'll be back in Beanpot again with more stories soon. The first stop is Miles Standish Hall, which is once the Miles Standish Hotel. In its hotel days, baseball superstar Babe Ruth used to be a regular guest at this hotel, with his favorite room being 818. Even though it has long since become a student dorm, it seems Babe Ruth isn't quite willing to let go of one of his favorite spaces, as he will come back to visit from time to time, giving quite a scare to any unsuspecting student who may stumble across his spirit. Miles Standish Hall is another holdover from its hotel days, and that is the uncle of playwright Arthur Miller.
Arthur.
Gotta get the R in the right spot. Anyway, he actually took his own life on the ninth floor of the one-time hotel. Miller based the main character of his play, Death of a Salesman, actually on his uncle. Students residing in this space will experience cold spots and sometimes see drawers opening on their own. It's an unsettling experience for sure. Boston University has a track record of turning old hotels into student housing because practical. Anyway, it's certainly easier than building from scratch in the middle of the big city. And the Charles Gate Hotel that was built in 1891 at the corner of Charles Gate East and Beacon Street along the north side of the city limits by the Charles River was purchased by Boston University in 1947 to be used as a dormitory. But after 26 years, the university sold it. It became tenement housing in 1973, and in 1981, Emerson College purchased it to use it as a dormitory after Boston University sold it. The building was turned into, the Charles Gate has seen many people from all walks of life over the years and endured several renovations. Allegedly, the mafia executed people in the building, and several residents committed suicide, although finding proof of these stories, of course, is difficult at best. Given the nature of the stories, it's unsurprising that it's unlike the benevolent spirit of Babe and that haunts the Miles Standish Hall, the spirit that haunts the Charles Gate is a little bit more sinister. In an article by Emerson Today, it expands on the haunting experiences in the infamous building, which some students reported sightings of dark figures in the room, toilets flushing unprompted, and alarms going off without being set. Others reported feelings of uneasiness, chills, and overall bad vibes. There are the slamming of doors, screams in the middle of the night, and of course, levitating objects. The hauntings of the former Charles Gate Hotel during Emerson's college era became so well known that the Berkeley Beacon and now defunct Boston Phoenix wrote several articles about it. Of the tales that have come out of the Charles Gate, though, the one that regularly rises above all the others and has a name to go with it, it's Elsa. She is the daughter of J. Pickering Putnam. Putnam was the architect of the Charles Gate and had a decorative wall tile holding Elsa's likeness placed near the elevator during the building's construction in 1891. Putnam's family lived in the Charles Gate after it was completed, and according to legend, 7-year-old Elsa fell down the elevator shaft to her death while chasing her ball across the hall. At that exact moment, the tile with her image cracked. Students claimed to see the ghost of the young girl searching the halls for her ball, as well as a new friend. But the story has a glaring problem. Elsa didn't die in the elevator shaft, nor did she die at the age of 7 years old, or inside Charles Gate at all. In fact, Elsa lived a full and active life until she passed away in 1979. So,
yeah.
Where does the story come from? Well, indeed, there was a decorative tile placed in the main lobby, and one could have very well been made in the likeness of Elsa. And of all the people that have come and gone over the years, well, it's possible that a 7-year-old girl passed away at the Charles Gate and subsequently returned to haunt the building. The sad truth is that this little girl is another unidentified spirit amongst the many at the Charles Gate, and attributing Elsa to the legend was an all-too-tempting opportunity for a storyteller to be loose with the relationship of the truth. Other causes for the hauntings at the Charles Gate have been noted or rumored over the years. Some point to a one-time use as a hospital. Others note it's quite possible that the Charles Gate was built over some graves in the initial construction. There are those stories that say that an evil cult lived at the Charles Gate during its tenement years. While it's become almost impossible to separate the truth from the rumor regarding the Charles Gate, it's undoubtedly one of the most storied and controversial buildings in the history of both Boston University and Emerson College. Today, the Charles Gate has left its academic days behind it. It's now a luxury condo complex with monthly rents and sale prices that are scarier than most ghost stories that we can share here. Yeah.
Well, I checked.
When I lived in Boston more than 20 years ago, it was scary then.
It's eye-popping.
Ouch. Let me just say ouch again.
Yeah.
I love the city. I can never live there.
Anyways.
Okay, so.
But yeah, it's unsurprisingly, all of these ghost stories are conveniently omitted from the sales literature for Charles Gate today.
Yeah. Just a historic building. So we're not quite done with Boston University yet. The next haunting is related to the infamous Boston Strangler. One of the Strangler's very last victims was Patricia Bissett, a resident of 515 Park Lane. Like the Miles Standish Hall in the Charles Gate, 515 Park Lane was a residential structure that was purchased and converted into student housing. Unlike the previously noted structures, the university didn't go through the trouble of trying to give it a name, and, well, we digress. The unfortunate Patricia was found murdered on December of 1962, and ever since her death, residents at this place have reported hearing footsteps in the middle of the night, and the building carries an entirely uneasy feeling to it. This raises the question, if the haunting is related to Patricia's murder, is it her spirit that lingers there, or some remnant of the Strangler? It's easy to understand why someone might be a little unsettled, knowing that an infamous murder or darkened the doorway of this building, even if it was over 60 years ago. Another converted Boston University building for you was the Shelton Hall. This is later renamed the Killikshan Hall. Built as a luxury apartment and hotel in 1923, the beautiful structure at 91 Bay State Road was first known as the Sheraton Apartment Hotel. It attracted several well-to-do residents, including Hollywood musical star Jeanette McDonald, Red Sox legend Ted Williams, and Nobel Prize-winning playwright Eugene Nabil and his wife Carlotta. Eugene and Carlotta lived in Unit 401 between 1951 and 1953, and then they had a tragically volatile relationship. And most accounts, Nabil was a difficult person to live with, as Carlotta was his third wife and he had a fractured relationship with his children. O'Neill was already in a tough place with his physical and mental health when he moved out of the unit. When he moved into the unit, and he would die there November 27th of 1953, at the age of 65. During his final days, O'Neill rarely left the apartment, and Carlotta lived in the apartment for a short time after O'Neill's death. During that interlude, she reported her dead husband visited her on several occasions, and that they had some long and meaningful conversation. Well, at least that happened.
It's saying something.
Yeah. Unfinished business. Anyway, it was shortly thereafter that Boston University purchased this building to use as a women's dorm in 1954. They named it Shelton Hall. Almost immediately, students started reporting doors opening and closing on their own, lights flickering, mysterious knocking, elevator doors would open without being summoned, and the lights on the fourth floor are perpetually dimmer than the other floors without explanation. The dormitory became co-ed in the 1970s, and in
2013, it was renamed Killichen Hall in honor of the parents of Boston University trustee Regine Killichen. It is now home to Killichen Honors College and continues to be the home of Boston University students, and no matter the name on the building, it can also continue to retain its haunted reputation.
I'm done for the night.
Clearly. You haven't even touched your drink.
Yes, I have. It's not finished, but I've touched it.
Barely.
I drank half of it.
If you say so.
I do say so.
But anyways, cheers, everybody. Hope that you enjoyed the story tonight. It was a fun one to research and get written up. Even if we did trip over half the words.
Yeah.
I wound up moving a crap load of stuff to what will be volumes 3, volumes 4,
and
the special international volume. So we've got at least another 3 Haunted University, College and University scripts in the works. We'll see if maybe they get a little dispersed among some other scripts. Who knows? Or we just got our go back to school.
Go back to school in January script.
Something. We got something. But yeah. Anyways, what are we doing again?
We're doing Massachusetts next, followed by Louisiana, I believe.
Let me see.
I think that's the right order.
Yes. So 2 weeks from now, by popular demand, we have Massachusetts, which will have more stories from Boston,
yep,
on top of the stories that we just finished with for this evening. So,
yep. Then we're doing Haunted Louisiana
at the end of the month.
And then we're going to be, for our 1 October show, we'll be doing Witches Part Whatever.
I think it's 3. I'm pretty sure it's 3.
I haven't saved this part 2. We're going to figure that out.
I can tell you right now. I know I'm right on this. I know I'm right. I don't get to say that very often, because I'm usually not. But this one I got. Got this one.
He's checking the YouTube.
Haunts of Richmond presents American Witch Stories, which was April 12th of 2021. And then Haunts of Richmond presents Witch Tales Volume 2, which aired January 16th of this year.
We also had Haunted Salem.
We did have Haunted Salem last November. And there were, of course, some witches stuff in that. So,
okay, so you need to rename it to part 3.
Yes, it is going to be part 3. Sorry, I got to take, when I'm right, I got to take it, because it almost never happens.
He's not going to let me forget it.
I'll let you forget it. I'm going to forget it. You know I'm going to forget it. I'm going to rename that script Volume 3, and I'm totally going to forget. Because that's how I roll. But anyway.
So come out, check us out for a tour this month. Chris and I will also be at Rich Brown the last Thursday of the month for Maker's Market.
That's next month. It's still August.
I keep trying to make it September already.
I have no idea what you're doing.
I don't know. But anyway.
So, yeah, the last Thursday of September, which is exactly 1 month from today, September 28th, we'll be at a market down at Rich Brow Brewing from 6 till 9. Beth will have her jewelry there.
Yep.
That'll be it, just jewelry, because it's a maker's market.
Yep.
So,
we'll have to, I'll haunt your anyway, we'll have our car's decal stickers, too.
Yeah,
so.
Mostly jewelry.
But mostly jewelry will be there. And then, of course, we'll be at
Nightmare Weekend
in October as panelists and as vendors.
Yep.
So.
But we have a couple of shows before that, so we'll be definitely talking that up, and it'll be on our, we'll get it all posted and all kinds of good stuff. But in the meantime.
I'm sorry, I'm fading fast.
In the meantime, we still have tour availability basically just about every night of the week, so you can check out our calendar, and if you enjoy the campus stories that we shared tonight, you can come check out our Creepy Tales on Campus tour that we have. You can use that, book that as a pick-your-own tour, or we, I think we have a couple of already scheduled a couple of times in
September.
Yep, so got that on the calendar a few times, and you can, of course, select it as your own. But, yeah, definitely highly recommend that one. Highly recommend all of our tours. Who am I kidding?
Yeah.
But, anyway.
Of course, eventually, Concert Richmond will have their corporate headquarters Halloween build out. We'll post pictures when it's up.
Yeah. So
it's still in the building process.
The huge box that you see over there on the table.
That's got pumpkins in it.
That is literally the tip of the iceberg when it comes to Halloween decorations that are jam-packed in that room. I think you can, oh, yeah, you can barely see that. That's the dark blob on top of said box is Yuna. She's been
that's her favorite spot right now. She's going to be very upset when I start actually moving up.
Yeah. Yep, so we got that, but
we bought 2 new skeletons.
Yes, we got, I think, well, we're up to 11 skeletons now? I don't know. We got enough.
6, 8, 9.
We got a small.
11 if you include the 2 little ones.
That's probably what I'm doing.
We got a skeleton for every staff member.
Yep. So, yeah. Anyways, we got all kinds of good stuff here. And, yeah. I guess that's it.
That is it.
I guess that is it for now. So.
We will catch you all later.
Yep. At the very least, we hope to see you back here in a couple of weeks for, again, Haunted Massachusetts. And if not sooner than that, come on out and join us on a tour sometime soon. So. Hope you all have a good evening, and we'll chat with you all again soon.
All right. Bye.
Stay spooky, everybody.